This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Check, check, check. Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you, no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are heroes around you. There are men and women who have put their lives on the line for the sake of our freedom. And we don't want to forget that. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice, preserve their stories so we don't forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way, we sure are educated, we're entertained, and a whole lot of times we're inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. We're going to get a story today from a gentleman who just turned 94, John Wagenhals of Sanger, California, but originally from a lot colder climate. What was the name of your hometown in Montana?
Glasgow, Montana.
Just like Scotland, but probably not as many people, huh?
Not as many people, but a lot colder.
What do you think the population of Glasgow was when you were growing up?
1,500, I would imagine. And I don't think it's a lot more right now. The younger people usually leave. Most of them go to college, actually, that come out of the high school. And of course, after they finish college, there's nothing really up there for them. So they leave. They go somewhere else. Unless they are part of a family which has got land holdings and large farms or have businesses or something like that, which most of them don't. Again, it almost requires that they leave if they want to, you know, get ahead somewhere.
And this is almost to the Canadian border, far northeastern Montana. How cold would it get when you were growing up there? What's the coldest you remember?
The coldest I remember is 60 degrees below zero.
What does that feel like?
Feels cold.
Does that feel like being at 20,000 feet in a B-17?
Yeah, even colder than that. And not only that, the summertime gets up around 110 or 115. So it was quite a spread of temperature, you know, from the hot to the cold all in 1 year's time, you know, go from 60 below to like about 110 above. So it's quite extreme.
Did you come from a big family? Were you an only child? Tell me about your family growing up and what you did to keep yourself busy in Glasgow, Montana.
I had two sisters and two brothers. While I was growing up, my dad was a tailor. He didn't make much money, you know, so we lived poor, I would say. When I was old enough, I started selling papers. And I'd get up at 6 o'clock in the morning, go peddle my papers, and then go to school. So I did that, and then my older brother, actually, he quit school in about the 10th grade because he wanted to go into the electrical stuff. And so he worked as electrical apprentice for a number of years, and then he had his own shop, electric shop, for a while. And eventually he retired out of that. And the girls, of course, they got married and had kids, and what the girls do.
And you wanted to move to the coast, or how did you end up in California?
You know, I really don't know. The only thing I can think, maybe, there was a large dam being built at Fort Peck, which was right out of Glasgow, and I had a motorcycle. And there was another guy that was from Van Nuys, California, and he had a motorcycle. And so the dam finished, and he left, and then I thought, well, if I want to go to California, I ought to maybe contact him. So I did. I contacted him. He says, yeah, come on down, you know. And he was a single guy. He was living in a house with a couple other guys. And so I went down there, and then I applied for a job at Lockheed in Burbank, I guess it was, and also applied for a job in San Diego, Consolidated Aircraft. They called first. So I moved to San Diego, and I was there helping them build the B-24 airplanes.
Where were you when the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor? And do you remember how you found out about that?
I was living in San Diego at the time, and I was on my way to work, actually, on the bus. And somebody said, first I'd heard about it, but it probably had happened hours before, that the Japanese had bombed Pearl Harbor. But that was the first time that I had heard about it, and I was on the way to work.
Well, I imagine there was quite a buzz at work about that, considering what your work was.
I don't think we got a lot done, actually, at work. We did more talking than working. So anyway, it was scary at that time because they kept talking about, well, they're going to bomb the West Coast. So we were worried about that, of course. And so anyway, it was a different time right after they bombed. You know, the lights went out. You know, all the windows were closed and the shades were pulled, and you couldn't do anything outside, you know, hardly at night, which would require any light. So it was a different time altogether, that's for sure.
Did you have any inkling at that point that it was going to change your life and what you would be doing before long?
I had no idea. I hadn't ever thought about the military, tell you the truth. Never thought about it. I didn't think I'd ever want to do that. I probably wouldn't have if it hadn't been for the Air Force. If it just been plain old Army, that didn't appeal to me at all.
It would have been plain old Army if you didn't do something about it. And I'm just putting the pieces together. And I don't know if I've ever interviewed anyone that worked on B-24s in a factory, flew in B-17s and B-29s, but before he got into the Army Air Corps, was working in a shipyard in Vallejo. That's quite the versatile repertoire we've got going there. How did you end up in the shipyard?
When I was at San Diego working in the aircraft factory, I didn't like it. I was working in what they call a drop hammer department, and it was so noisy. Oh, I mean, just terrible noisy. So I wanted to get out of there. So I applied for a job at Vallejo Shipyard. And so it wasn't long. I got a call from them. They said, yeah, we have a job for you here. We'll expect you to come up in a week or so or whatever it was and get settled in. I said, okay, fine, I'll be there. So I got out of the drop hammer department, which was so noisy, but I didn't really want to leave San Diego because it was so nice. But that's what you have to do.
Well, I think you're pretty thankful now that you left San Diego because there was something pretty important that happened in Vallejo, right?
Oh, yeah, yes. Of course, I met my future wife there. We had 65 years together. We had two kids, you know, and so it's been a good life. It's been a good life. We did a lot of things, you know, and I've enjoyed it, and I have no regrets.
I've seen the wedding photos and see how happy you and Marie looked on that day, but do you remember how she first caught your eye? What was that that first moment that you said, hey, this one's pretty special?
Yeah, the first time I saw her, she was in a white uniform, which all the waitresses had on at the cafeteria. We were the single men and the others that were living in this barracks sort of situation. She was there, and I ordered a piece of cherry pie. And she brought it over, and I thought, geez, how pretty. How pretty. I'd like to know that girl. So anyway, she brought me the pie. The pie was 10 cents, and I left her a 25-cent tip. And that was a big hit for her.
Guys, are you listening? He just gave you the secret. But you didn't get married till you got back from overseas?
That's right, yeah. We were engaged before I went overseas, and then we waited. You know, I didn't know what was going to happen while I was over there. Yeah. So we thought we would wait, and when I came home, we got married. I was home for a week or so before we got married. And then she went with me to the next bases. And we lived together, you know, on the basis.
But there was quite a bit you had to survive in order to come home to marry her. And then we better get the story of how you ended up in the Air Corps, because you got word from Montana that they were going to draft you. And you didn't want that to be the way it went down, huh?
No, I didn't want to be a gunslinger or whatever you want to call those guys, you know, and crawling around on the ground. That just did not appeal to me. So I thought, well, I'm going to get into the Air Force. A little later, I found out, you know, about the Aviation Cadet Program. Up to about that time, you had to have at least two years of college before you could get into the cadet program. And so then they opened it up. If you could pass a certain test, you could get into the program. And so I did that, and I took classes to learn kind of about what they were going to be wanting to know on the test. And so I took the test and then was admitted as a cadet. But because of the backlog of people, there was about 3 months from the time I enlisted until I actually got into uniform, because they just didn't have space for the people. And then from then on, you know, aviation cadet program, it lasted about 3 months or 4 months on the basics of military and so forth. And then after that came the bombardier school.
Were you hoping to be a pilot when you went in?
Oh, yeah, sure, yeah.
And probably everybody was, right?
Yeah, everybody was. And they had the classification where you were classified either bombardier, navigator, or pilot, or all three, or two, or whatever. And most of us qualified for all three. But then it depended on what their needs were at that time, whether you would go to pilot school, bombardier school, or whatever. So the Germans had kind of changed their method of attack. It used to be a kind of a tail-end attack, coming in from the back, or coming in from a kind of a quarterback to head-on. And then when the head-on started coming, that's when they started losing the bombardiers. And so that's why they had such a shortage. And so So many of us that went in at the same time ended up in bombardier school. So it was okay.
Well, it can't be very encouraging, though, if you find out, well, the reason we need bombardiers is because they sit in the nose and they're getting shot by all the German fighters. What were you getting yourself into there?
We knew what was going on, but it wouldn't happen to us. You know, it would be the next guy that was going to get shot down, not us.
And you ended up flying more than 30 missions in B-17s. During World War II. In fact, if folks are driving up Highway 99 in Central California, they go past Mefford Field in Tulare. The B-17 there has the markings of your 379th Bomb Group and a big K for Kim Bolton, England. But was there anything between starting and getting to that base in England that got your attention or an interesting experience along the way before you even got overseas?
The most interesting part was meeting all these people from all over the United States. You know, they were just everybody, and they were all so nice. All these young guys, you know, like myself, and we were all close together because we were confined to barracks, and whatever we did, we always did it as a group. And I got to know some of the greatest people that I've ever known, and I hope they're still alive and doing well, too. But that was, I think that was about the most interesting and important thing that I learned, you know, was to how to associate with all these nice people. It was really good. I enjoyed it.
And I've talked to some guys who flew with the same crew on the vast majority of their missions and other guys who, just because of timing and everything, ended up with five or six different pilots and different crew members. How was it for you? Did you have the same crew for most of what you did?
Yes, we did. We had the same airplane for most of what we had. When we first got there in England, we had flown an airplane over from United States to England, but they were going to do some modifications on it, so that did not become our airplane for our combat flying. We flew, I think, three missions in three different airplanes to start, and then the fourth mission, I think it was, we flew in an airplane that somebody had named Busy Baby, and so we finished flying all of our missions in that one airplane, and we all stuck together. We all survived. You know, nobody actually got hurt. We got shot up, you know, plenty, but everybody survived in pretty good shape. Physically and mentally.
That first mission, were there some nerves for you? Was there some adrenaline pumping? Because, I mean, I know you've practiced and you've had all this training, but really you've never done that before, right?
That's right. And, you know, we knew they were losing a lot of airplanes and losing a lot of people, and airplanes were getting shot up pretty bad, and they're coming in with one engine out or two engines out. And so, you know, worried about it, you know. So anyway, we took off. We were flying towards the mission. We got towards the target, probably on what we'd call the bomb run, which is probably about 15 miles ahead of the target. And we could see them shooting at us, but they were quite some distance away. They weren't very accurate at the time. They were low. They were not very good, to tell you the truth, at shooting at us, and we were thankful for that. So then in my mind, I thought, well, what's the big deal here? This is a piece of cake. So we got through that one fine. I went back and I said, yeah, you is. That's okay. We're going to get through this in fine shape. Well, the next mission was Berlin. That was a different story. They must have been 1,000 guns aimed at us, you know, up there. And it was all of us were going, a whole Air Force, I think, was going to Berlin, but we had different targets in Berlin. We would fly and they would throw up the any aircraft in sort of a box formation that they knew we were going to have to fly through to get to the target, and they would just keep pumping it up into that box, and then when it got farther along, they would move the box towards the target. And I mean, airplanes were going down like crazy, you know, so it was really bad. So that scared the hell out of me.
Well, yeah, and you're probably the guy that has the worst position on the plane for that, because I mean, a guy in the tail or at the waist gun, he doesn't see it all coming, but you're right there in the nose, and you see it all before you have to fly through it, right?
You see it, and you wonder how you're going to get through it, you know, because, I mean, it's thick. It just almost obliterates the view, you know, from the explosion of the shells, you know, large 88s. You just can't imagine being able to fly through that. And then at the same time, you can see, well, this guy's dropping out. He's got some problem, or this guy's going down. This guy's on fire. You know, and it's that kind of thing all the way along there for a good 30 minutes probably before you get to the bomb run. And they kind of leave you alone during the bomb run because they don't want to get shot down either, you know, for that matter. So, and then the fighters that were coming in. So, and then after you finish, you drop your bombs and you get out of the way, they're back after you again. So it's a never-ending thing, it seemed like, for a while. Especially during the first part of my tour over there, when we had fighter escort would take us about halfway to the targets. then the other halfway you're on your own, you know, just the bombers and the stream of bombers. So there was enough bombers that it provided a certain amount of protection, you know, but they were going down pretty fast.
And I'm sure there's some moments in all those missions that you wondered if you were going to bring that plane in. I want to ak you, though, since we're on the topic of flak and you just described that, that moment before you enter that box, as you described it, of all the flak, what are you doing? I mean, are you bracing yourself? Are you closing your eyes and clenching your teeth? Are you saying a prayer? What in the world are you doing?
Looking for the target, really, actually, yeah. Is what happens, yeah. So you're looking for the target to see where it is, and you start looking for your points of interest that you can find along the way that helps guide you to the target as you're looking, you know, because it's too far away to actually see the target at that point. But you can line up on the other things that you know where they are, which are in line with the target. You see that, and then you see all this flak, and you say, oh, my God, how am I ever going to get through this, you know? And it's incredible. It's incredible. It's a wonder anybody survived.
Especially when you know you have to just stay on course and stay in formation. And maybe some of our listeners don't know that when you start that bomb run, it's not the pilot who's controlling the airplane anymore, right?
That's right, yeah. And there's no deviation. You get on course, and you stay on course, regardless of what's coming up at you. You just keep on going, because once you set your sight for the target, you're locked in. And that's where it has to be.
And you, as the bombardier, are now in charge of the plane and responsible for that 10-man crew, right?
Yeah, it's actually the bomb sight, using the bomb sight and making corrections in the bomb sight, which turns the airplane. And so it'll turn the airplane left or right, but the elevation is up to the pilot. He's got to keep the altitude at the right height. If he deviates a couple hundred feet, that throws the bombs way off the target. So he's got to do that, and he's got to be good at that too.
And when it comes to those bombs being on target, I know there's a strategic import, obviously, of hitting the right spot that you were assigned to hit, but I wonder, too, for you, just as a human being, and you're, what, 23, 24 years old at this point?
I think I was 22 or 23.
I mean, how much responsibility did you feel to hit the right target, knowing that the wrong target might take out civilians or might do some damage that certainly you weren't intending to do?
Well, you want to hit the right target, and you want to take it out, because if you don't, it means coming back again the next day. So you might as well get that over with. And as far as damage to the civilian population, you just can't let that bother you. That's war. That's all there is to it, you know. If you let that bother you, you'd just go absolutely nuts, I would imagine. So I know there were a lot of people killed by our bombs.
Well, and I just wonder, as you describe that, is that the understanding of someone who's 94 and flew more than 80 missions between World War II and Korea compared to maybe that 24-year-old flying his first bomb mission? Did it take you a while to arrive at that? Was it hard to get to that point emotionally?
Yeah, I think so. Even at the beginning, though, we knew that other people would get hurt besides those that are in the target area. And not every bomb hit the target, you know, that's for sure. So there was a lot of corollary damage done, which included homes, houses, hospitals, office buildings, anything. But that was just part of it, you know. We didn't have the laser-type aiming situation that they have now, where they could, you know, just aim right at it and away it goes. That's it. So we didn't have that.
Did you have the Norden bombsight, or was that before this?
We had the Norden bombsight, which was good, but at 25,000 feet, which was mostly where we were flying, I would say a good strike would be within 200 feet of the target. That would be good. And so most cases we would accomplish that. But sometimes there were times when they hit the wrong target. You know, it's something that might look like the same. But in most cases, I think it was fairly effective considering the equipment we had to work with.
Well, it's time for our first break, but we're just getting started with 94-year-old John Wagenhals, a veteran of World War II and the Korean War. When we come back, what was it really like in the nose of a B-17? And before we're done, his close calls in B-29s as well. More of Hometown Heroes right after this.
You know, one of the things I appreciate so much about the veterans we meet on Hometown Heroes is that they're real.
a sincere and genuine spirit really makes an impression on me, and that's why I'm such a big fan of Educational Employees Credit Union. It was EECU that spearheaded the launch of Central Valley Honor Flight with an initial donation of close to $25,000, and the giving did not end there. More than 200,000 members know EECU represents smarter banking, but it's not just about being smart, it's about the heart. I've worked with the folks at EECU for years, and I've watched them put their money where their mouth is, supporting their credit union members right where they live in hometowns up and down Central California. From sponsoring first-class Educator of the Year ceremonies to taking the lead in sending World War II veterans on an unforgettable journey, my friends at EECU keep proving that you are at the heart of everything they do. Go to myeecu.org to see what EECU can do for you, or just walk into any branch. And while you're there, if you enjoy this show, tell them thanks for supporting Hometown Heroes.
On the front line of freedom, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. You know, in today's world, we're so accustomed to flying at 25,000 feet or even higher. And with those pressurized cabins, we don't even notice a difference. But our guest today, B-17 Bombardier John Wagenhals, and all the other veterans who flew high-altitude bombing missions in World War II, did not have that luxury. Can you give us a sense of what those conditions were like without pressurized cabins, what you guys actually had to do just to even survive up there?
Well, yeah, it was, you know, it was like 50, 60 below zero, I guess, at that altitude. We had electric heated suits. They worked fairly good. And then, of course, we had leather fur-lined uniforms, pants and jacket, and we could hardly move. We had so much stuff on, but we were almost comfortable, you know, in spite of all the bad weather and all this kind of thing that was going on. So it didn't really, I don't think there was an effect as far as the temperature was concerned, although it was cold.
And that heated suit always worked for you, huh?
Most of the time.
Good thing you're from Glasgow, Montana, for the times it didn't.
So once in a while, they'd short circuit and you'd be dead, you know, the circuit would be absolutely dead. Yeah. And you'd have to just depend on your big wool leather jacket and leather pants to keep you warm.
You know, speaking of Glasgow, I just total tangent here, but I'm just curious, did you get a chance to see Glasgow, Scotland while you were over that way?
Yeah, matter of fact, we flew from Goose Bay, Newfoundland to Wales. We got on a train or something and we went to Scotland. And yeah, we were at Glasgow, Scotland for a while. And I made a big deal out of that. And then we were boated across over to England after that. So, yeah, I got to see it.
As far as some of these missions, and I talk about close calls, and I don't mean to make light of what you went through. I have to imagine when you guys are flying sometimes day after day after day, that there were some situations where you really did wonder if you guys were going to bring that plane back in. What are the ones that really stand out to you?
What really bothered me more than anything, I think, was the fact we were coming home, flying formation, and we were in an element of four airplanes. We were not the lead airplane. We were flying the right of the lead airplane. The airplane on the left moved over, and he got underneath the lead airplane. And he kept moving it up and up and up and up. We kept seeing this. Well, why is this guy doing that? He's underneath this airplane, and he's moving the thing up, making it go higher and higher and higher. Why is the guy doing that? So anyway, pretty soon, he went back to his position, and he was flying there for a little while, and the next thing we know, he's flying right into the lead airplane, and he crashed right into him, and they both tumbled down into the river, what is the river in London, Thames. Yeah, he went into that thing, and that's been kind of a sad part of it, was two airplanes almost home. What they probably said was the guy that was causing all this was probably having vertigo, and he didn't realize where he was in the air, and probably the co-pilot was sleeping, which wasn't uncommon. And so he was there probably pretty much alone, and he just couldn't tell where he was, and he was just all over the sky. And so he moved us over a time also, too, for that matter, but not that far. Anyway, that was kind of sad to see these guys go down after they had flown the mission. Before, it'd be a different story, you know, because they might have got shot down anyway. But this way, to go down under those circumstances was not, that was sad.
Were there any survivors, or was that 20 guys?
There were a few survivors. Matter of fact, the pilot of that airplane, I've communicated with him, too. He had taken the right-hand seat, the co-pilot seat, to give the other guy, the co-pilot seat, some pilot time because he wanted to get checked out as the first pilot instead of a co-pilot. So the co-pilot was actually flying the airplane, and it got hit on his side, and of course he got lost. But the co-pilot, who was actually the pilot, he got out and he survived. And I think they said there were like four or five people out of the two airplanes that survived.
And obviously he wouldn't have if he hadn't switched spots with the co-pilot. And did you have some moments like that that kind of took your breath away and said, boy, that could have been me right there?
Well, all of them are like that. Yeah, we worried, you know, I don't know, you see the fighters coming in, you see the flak coming up, and you just know damn well you're going to get hit one of these times. It just can't go on forever.
Can you help us understand what it feels like when you get hit by flak? I mean, I imagine it's got to be pretty loud, and you can feel some vibration or maybe even something in your flesh at times, huh?
Yeah, you can feel it, and you can feel the explosion of the shell as it explodes, because it just explodes into a thousand little pieces. You can hear it. And you can feel it move the airplane a little bit. Not a lot, but you can feel it move it. I guess if you hear it, what they said to you, you don't have any problem. It's the one you don't hear that's probably got you. It was scary. It was very scary.
And you mentioned fighters coming at you, and there were times where you had escort up until a certain point. But again, I'm just thinking about you being where you are in the nose of that B-17 with probably the best view of anybody to see what's coming. Were there some close encounters with enemy aircraft?
They would fly. See, I was also a gunner. I had guns up front there. And so I was pumping away with the guns, and I'd see these guys coming in. I don't know. I probably hit some, I imagine. But it wasn't every time that we got hit with fighters, but it was often enough. I didn't like it. But yeah, you see a lot going on, and all of a sudden you see an airplane that's not there anymore. So he's just puffing, he's gone.
What was the worst damage that your plane sustained in all those missions?
Well, we came home, I think actually it was on the second mission to Berlin, or shortly after. I don't know how many holes was in the airplane, but one engine was shot out to begin with. Then pretty soon, the other one got so it wasn't working very good, so we started throwing everything out we could to lessen the weight of the airplane to keep it flying. And so we put guns we could dismantle and flak suits on the way home. We threw them out and just about everything we could get that was loose so that we could stay in the air. And so we finally made it back, but we didn't make it back to our base. We made it back to the first base that we could find in England. And we just went there, and then they trucked us back to our base, and then they fixed up the airplane. I don't know, it's probably a week or so, then the airplane was flown back to our base and we flew it again. So.
And you made that sound like no big deal, but I imagine while that was happening, there were some nervous guys on that B-17.
We were preparing for ditching, actually, because we didn't think we were going to make it back to the England. Like I say, we threw out the stuff, but we also prepared for the ditching. And the pilot says, you know your positions for ditching. Yes, I know mine. Okay, tell me where it is. And so each one checked in. I know where I'm supposed to be if we're going to ditch. And so everything was pretty well organized if that would have happened. And my position in the front, I was to go back into the radio room because that would be a bad place to be and you have to ditch. So everyone called in and says, yes, we're all set. So we're ready to go. Just give us the word and we'll go ahead and get to the positions.
And very relieved, obviously, you never got that word. Is that when you get home from a mission like that, is that one that you guys celebrate a little bit?
Yeah, it's a celebration, all right, you know, and a relief more than anything, you know. So, and I don't know, it just seems like you're euphoric after having got through it and you're still alive. It was a celebration, all right. We would take two shots of whiskey instead of one.
Well, and you mentioned having that same plane, Busy Baby, for most of your missions, and you just described that mission where you weren't sure if you're going to make it. It makes me wonder how much respect and trust and admiration you had for your pilot.
Yes, we had a really good pilot, and the co-pilot both were. I think all of those guys were really good and dedicated, you know. So I was pleased with him, and I wouldn't have asked for another pilot under any circumstances because I was perfectly satisfied.
Was there a connection among that crew that stood out to you? I've had a lot of guys just say that maybe they can't even explain the bond that they formed with those other guys that they went through those things with. What do you remember about the guys on your crew and how you guys interacted and got along?
Well, I suppose I was more friendly with the co-pilot, and next probably would have been the radio operator. Some reason or other, he and I were just hit it off really good. And we used to go to town together, sometimes with the co-pilot, sometimes with the radio guy. And we'd go to town and see if we couldn't chase a few girls around, you know, and have some fun. So anyway, I remember them all, you know, like it was yesterday, really. So I'll never forget them.
Well, if your memory's that sharp, then I've got a couple other questions to ask you. I'm looking at your list of missions here, and I see June 2nd of 44, you guys flew to France. June 4th of 44, you guys flew to France. June 5th of 44, you flew to France. What about June 6th, 44? Did you guys hear what was going on? Because there were a whole lot of planes in the sky that day.
I was on a three-day leave. We flew the day before. Okay, see, the 6th is missing. The 5th, and then it looks like it didn't fly again till the 12th. Yeah, so it looks like there's a week we had off. So that was pretty nice. The thing is, those were short missions, and they were actually, if you will, safe. Yeah. You know, there was any very little anti-aircraft gun, and the fighters had probably been pretty much taken care of by that time. So we felt like we kind of missed a couple of missions instead of going there for maybe a 3-hour flight, go somewhere for 8 hours, and get all shot up.
When you guys heard about what was happening, was it big news that the Allies had hit the Normandy beaches and attacked?
Of course, we were in England, in downtown London, probably, at the time we first heard about it. And so, it was really big news. We were on our way. We're going to finish this thing up. And the poor English people, you know, they'd been beaten so bad, felt sorry for them. But now they were beginning to see that this thing is going to end sooner or later.
Well, it would be a long time, another year almost, till that war ended, but it would end before that for you because you got your missions in. When you went in, was it 25 missions and you come home?
When I went in, yes, it was. It was 25 missions and you come home, and then they shortly after that, they jacked it up to 30, and then they jacked it up to 35, but then they prorated them out. See, depending on how close you were to 30, you know, or how much over 30 you were, they would prorate them out. So I ended up, I think, with 32 or 33, 32. So that was enough.
But for a while, they keep changing the number, and you're saying, hey, am I ever going to get there?
That's exactly right. And that's the way it looked like. And proration came out a little bit later. You know, it said, okay, now you're going to fly 35. Said, oh, my God. So then they finally changed their tune about that a little bit, and they prorated where we were at that time so that we didn't have to fly the full 35.
Well, and, you know, somebody's listening and says, well, what's the big deal? That's just a number. But no, it wasn't. I mean, you realize you beat some pretty significant odds, don't you?
You can take a look at this, where we were. You know, Zinowitz was where they were testing their missiles. Wernher von Braun, he was the head chief at Zinowitz at that time. And so it was our goal at that time. I don't know what time we left, but we were to catch the people in bed, and we were to catch him on a Sunday morning. So we probably got to the target like 6 o'clock in the morning so that they were still in bed and not aware of what was going on and not even thinking about us. And so we bombed that place, and they were making the so-called heavy water for the atom bomb and all that kind of stuff there. It was one of the most significant experimental stations for bombs and that kind of thing. So we were glad to do what we did, but I don't know how much it paid in the long run.
And that brings to mind another question. How good a picture, or how complete a picture, did you guys ever get of what damage you'd actually done, or how significant one of your missions was going to prove to be? Did you have any sense of that at the time?
Yes, we would see the strike photos, but you have to really interpret those things, and we didn't get to that. They had the people that were really taking care of the photos, and they could spot things that we would never recognize. And so although we could see that, things are all blown up, but you don't know there's a lot of things that weren't. So the other people, they could tell that.
Again, just looking at your list of missions, I see one on July 7th of 1944, your 24th birthday, bombing an aircraft factory in Leipzig, Germany. Do you remember that?
Well, not really. But Leipzig was never an easy target either, for that matter. So, and do that on my birthday? No, it was a good birthday. I survived.
Amen. You've survived a few of them since then, too. When you found out that you were going to get to come home, what was that like for you? Because the war wasn't over yet, and you knew some of your buddies would still be flying. But were you excited about your opportunity?
Oh, yeah. We were waiting. We were watching our numbers, you know, and we knew how many we had to fly before we were able to go home. When the last one came, and you know, that's the one you're really worried about. Am I going to get knocked down on the last flight? And so when it was over, wow, hooray, I'm going home. I'm going home.
Through all of those, I know it's hard to catalog them all instantly, but what do you think was the moment where you felt the most intensely a sense of fear or anxiety or doubt as to whether you would come home and see Marie again and do any of the things that you've done in all these years?
Well, the second mission, Berlin. Here's a picture of it. That's what you fly through. And it just doesn't seem any way possible that you're going to get through it. And you see, these airplanes are all out of formation, really. They're going to get picked off, no question about it. So they've been damaged, and they're out of position, they're out of formation, and they're easy pickings for the fighters now. So it just seemed impossible to get through that, but the majority of us did, so we made it.
Yeah, the picture just shows clouds of black smoke just about everywhere across the horizon and a few B-17s trying to get away from it. What seemed impossible wasn't, at least not for John Wagenhals and his crewmates. You did make it home. You got to marry your sweetheart, who you'd met at the shipyards before you headed overseas. And you may not have realized it at the time, but you hadn't flown your final mission. When we come back, a different plane, a different war, but more close calls in the sky for Bombardier John Wagenhals. Just celebrated his 94th birthday. And we'll have the rest of his story when Hometown Heroes continues after this.
This is Hometown Heroes. Hometown Heroes. Honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, visiting today with 94-year-old John Wagenhals of Sanger, California. He still drives his prized Red Thunderbird and cuts his lawn on his riding mower. Those vehicles a little different from the B-17s he was flying in as a bombardier during World War II or those big B-29s he served in during the Korean War. We're going to get to that, but we left off with Mr. Wagenhals coming home after completing those 32 missions over Europe in World War II.
When I got back, it looked like the war was going to go on for a while, I applied for pilot training. So I started pilot training, and I got into what they call pre-flight again. And I was in Georgia, Maxwell Air Force Base, and the war ended. I talked with Marie, and she says, "I want you to come home. Come on home, honey, you know." So, well, what could I do? So I says, "Okay, I'm out of here, you know." Because if I stay in, the deal was that you go through the pilot training, and then you are committed for 3 years after that. And so that meant basically 4 years. I wasn't really ready for that either, you know, and then a little persuasion from her, then I'm on my way home.
I don't hear any regret in your voice about that either. You mentioned the war coming to an end, and you find out while you're there in Georgia. Was that a big deal to you? Because you'd had a lot to do with what happened there. You had certainly done your part. What did it mean to you to find out that this war was over and that your side had emerged victorious?
I was glad for all the people that were still fighting, really, and especially the guys on the ground. Oh, they were having such a terrible time around the Berlin area and the cold that they were enduring. And it was just a terrible time for those guys. And at least when we got home, everything was fine. But I was so happy for them that this thing was over. They didn't have to endure this any longer.
And when you did honor Marie's wishes and come back to California and leave the Air Force at that time, I guess it was still the Army Air Corps until 48. Did you think you were ever going to be up in the sky in a bomber again?
No, I didn't. I did stay in the reserves, but it seemed like everything was going along pretty well. You know, it was 46, 47, 48, and everything still looking pretty good. And 49, and then when they invaded South Korea, you know, and that kind of thing, it started all over again. And it wasn't long they called my number again, back in the service in 1950. And trained then in B-29s, so which was kind of nice, you know, in a nice airplane. And then it wasn't long, I was sent over to Okinawa, and I was put on a crew and flying from Okinawa to Korea. And I was over there for almost a year. That included somewhere around 50 missions. Most of them were not too bad. They were long. Some of them were very long. I think some were long, like 15 hours. Most of them run around 10 hours and that. But actually, it was not as dangerous as World War II in the sense that the enemy was, you know, the strength that they had over in Germany and the equipment that they had. But they finally got to us pretty good.
Well, I did see a photo of a hole in your bomb bay doors.
Yeah, that's right.
What happened there?
I don't know. There weren't many of us that went. I think there were only about 12 airplanes. We were going to bomb an air base, and that was pretty close to the Russian border. and the Russians actually were flying the Korean airplanes, so that they were Russian airplanes with Korean markings.
But Russian pilots.
And Russian pilots, that's right. So anyway, this one particular day, they just swarmed all over us. We had 12 airplanes. Four of them went down right just before the target. They were hit bad, and we got hit too, but our lead crew guy, he got hit, he went down. And I think there were, of the 12 of us, only two of us actually made it back to Okinawa. And we had the damage with the bomb bay doors, and I was able to get back up there and wire them up so that they wouldn't be too much drag on the airplane. And so we were able to make it back home. But there were two of us got back home, but about three or four of them, they landed safely at airports in South Korea. And then there was a number that just, they're gone. That's all, they're gone.
It could have been you.
If he'd been a foot higher, he would have got us.
And what did he hit you with? The cannon on the nose of his plane?
It was a cannon shot, you know, and he hit sort of at the top of the bomb bay doors, which just kind of split them right down the middle. If it had been another 2 feet higher, it would have been right in the bomb bay section. And I don't know what would have happened. And I don't know if the bombs would explode or not, but I kind of doubt that. But anyway, it would have damaged the airplane enough to cause it unflyable.
Inches matter, huh?
Yes. Yes, they do. Yeah. Inches matter.
And you mentioned very nonchalantly that you went down there and wired those doors. What did that entail? Did you have to go out on a catwalk? I mean, how did you do that? What did that entail?
Yeah, there's a catwalk about a foot wide. I had one guy, he was standing behind the bomb bay and, you know, kind of watching out for me, if you will. I had to lay down on the catwalk, reach down and pull up one section of the bomb bay. And we have wires that are connected to the bomb, which keeps the bomb safe until the wire pulls away from the bomb. And then these wires, they stay in the aircraft, and they're about 3 feet long. So I was able to get enough of those together to pull up the bomb bay door, the half sections at a time, wire them up, hold them up into place pretty decently, I guess. I did that for all of the different sections of the bomb bay and got them up in place. And so we thought, well, with that, we probably can make it home okay. Otherwise, it would be too much drag on the airplane, and we'd have to land either in Japan or down in Southern Korea. So we got them up okay, and again, you know, nothing seems like a big deal until it's over with. You know, you do what you have to do, and you go ahead and do it.
I'm wondering if any of those industrial arts students you had at Fresno City College in all the years, or the teachers and students you oversaw when you were an administrator in Fresno Unified, ever heard the story of you lying on your belly on a catwalk with some interesting scenery going down below and probably a whole lot of wind at your face too, huh?
Yeah, and going pretty fast trying to get out of there, you know, so there was no question about that. We probably dumped the bombs a little bit before we should have, maybe, because we were getting shot up and everybody else was getting shot up. And so we dumped the bombs and trying to get the hell out of there. Get out as fast as you can. So I guess it meant to the pilot, drop the nose a little bit of that airplane to get some speed going. So we did that, and we got out of there, and we got shot at several times on our way out of there, but we got missed. Those guys don't always hit you and they're shooting at you, and that's good news. But we got out of there okay.
Well, and I guess what I wonder, and maybe there's no way to answer, is you talk about them shooting at you and missing. Might they have had a better chance at hitting you if you hadn't done that to the bomb bay doors to help your aerodynamics?
That's questionable, I suppose. You know, I really don't know. I don't think I could answer that, but it seems like we would be going slower probably than we would otherwise, which might make it a little easier target. I don't know, but we could see them flashes coming at us and missing, but there's nothing you can do, you know, because you see the flash and it's just that quick way the shell is at you or past you or whatever, or hit you, one or the other. So there's nothing you can do about that.
I know you recently had the opportunity to go to Washington, D.C. to see the World War II Memorial, but also the Korean War Memorial. And I imagine on a plane full of World War II vets, you were one of the few that actually served in both of those wars. What was that experience like for you? What did it mean to you to visit those two spots?
I visit those two spots, of course, very emotionally. I kind of got over that, and then I saw the Air Force Memorial, and that was euphoric. I mean, that was so beautiful. And that just took away all the worries I ever had. You know, I just thought that was such a beautiful memorial, you know. It just looks like three airplanes taking off and away they go.
You mentioned getting emotional. Is that because you thought of the guys who didn't come home and maybe you could have been in their place? I mean, I don't want to put thoughts in your head or words in your mouth, but what did that do to you?
It's part of that, but I think more than that was I watched so many of those guys break down, you know, that we were on the Honors flight, actually start crying and doubling up. And, you know, you just feel so sorry for them. And they're just reliving some of the things that they went through during the World War II. And most of them happened to be Army guys, you know, on the flight I was on. I think there was only one other Air Force guy on it. And I know I felt so sorry for those guys because they were just having a really tough time. Visiting those memorials.
I know you spent a good chunk of your life in education, and you know, I think about the younger generations of your family and of all of our families, those of us who weren't alive during World War II or certainly the Korean War. What do you think we need to know about what happened then, what you guys did, why you did it, and why we need to remember it today?
All these things have a beginning and they have an end. And what happens in between, I don't know, it can be horrible. And in some cases, you know, it's only the right thing to do, as bad as it is. The winner, of course, always feels bad for the loser. It's just terrible to see what destruction takes place and why it had to happen. And the sad part of it is it's still going on. You know, it doesn't seem like it wants to stop. I don't know. I just can't understand the politics of all of this. You know, it seems like that seems like there should be a resolution of some sort where we don't have to keep doing this kind of thing. I get upset about it sometimes, but nothing I can do.
When I imagine some of that, when you say you feel upset, that you guys probably believed that if you finished this job, that hopefully no one would have to take up that kind of task again, right?
Well, that was the thought at the time, but it didn't last long.
Well, I'm sure we could sit here talking for hours, and if there's anything else that comes to mind for you, let me know. But I just want to say before I forget, thank you for serving our country. Thank you for telling us about it. What's your secret to staying so young? Because you're 94, but you don't look it, you don't sound it. Is there something you can share with the rest of us to give us some hope?
The only thing I could share with you, which is impossible now, would be my mother. She lived to be 97, and she was just as sharp when she died as she had been all her life. She's got the genes.
What are you most proud of, and what are you most thankful for?
Well, I'm thankful to still be here, for one thing. You know, and having gotten through that, proud. I don't know, I just feel like I did what everybody else did. You know, I don't feel any different about that, and I don't talk about it in a heroic sense or anything like that. Sometimes I just lay it out like it is, and that's as far as I want to go with it. So they can take it or leave it.
Well, and I think that attitude has come through today. Before we go, you know, I do tend to bend our listeners' ears about Honor Flight a lot, reminding them that wherever they live, there is an Honor Flight affiliate nearby, hoping to give every World War II veteran who wants to visit the National World War II Memorial a chance to do just that. I know you got rained on a bit on your trip to Washington, D.C. from Fresno, but I saw you there with your Central Valley Honor Flight hat on, welcoming back our next group of veterans after that. So what do you tell people when they notice that hat and they ask you about Honor Flight?
Oh, that's great. It's really great, really great. And I'm so hopeful that some of these people that haven't signed up for it do, you know, get a chance to go. Seeing them is just part of it. Being with these guys, that's really the nice part of it. You know, it's being with all those guys. They're so humble and so great. And I don't know, some of those guys are living so hard right now. You know, we had one guy that celebrated his 99th birthday on the, so that was really neat. And
did you find that it was easier to talk about what you did in the war because you knew all those guys went through similar things?
Yeah, and at the same time, it seemed like, you know, they all kind of downplay what they did. There's nobody bragging about anything, not at all. And so I really respect them for that. They're not blowing themselves up to be something that they're not. Yeah, and so really wonderful bunch of guys, you know, and I'll never forget them. Never.
Well, I know they all feel the very same way about you. John Wagenhals, 94 years old. You can find photos of him then and now on the Hometown Heroes Facebook page or at hometownheroesradio.com. Don't forget about the contest there where you can win 4 free tickets to Universal Studios Hollywood. We're out of time this time. I'm Paul Leffler, hoping you'll join us again next time and that you'll let these stories from our veterans always remind you that freedom is not free. Oftentimes, there's a little more to an interview than what can fit into the time constraints of an hour-long radio show, and that's where these podcasts come in real handy. If you're listening from California's Central Valley, where Mr. Wagon Halls lives, you've probably driven by the B-17 you may have heard me mention earlier. It sits at the edge of Mefford Field on the east side of the 99 freeway in Tulare. It's painted with the markings of the 379th Bomb Group, and it has Preston's Pride painted on the nose. That's for General Maurice Preston, a Tulare Union High School graduate who flew that very plane to Tulare County himself in 1958. During World War II, Preston was Colonel Moe, the commander of the 379th Bomb Group. And I talked to Mr. Wagon Halls about Colonel Moe and the plane that represents his legacy.
Colonel Moe, of course, I have a connection to him, but as far as the airplane is concerned, I think it was a different squadron than I was in, so I have no connection to the airplane. Colonel Moe was quite a guy, cigar-chomping guy. He was a whole bomb group commander, yeah, and he was from Tulare, yeah. And he had a brother, and the brother was a West Point graduate, and he was a pilot, but he was assigned to our crew as a navigator. Really? I said, you're Colonel Moe's brother, and they stuck you here as a navigator? He says, yeah, I'm here as a navigator. He says, but not for long, I don't think. So I guess we just needed navigators or something at the time, and so they put him in there. He was a brother to Colonel Moe, younger brother. Yeah. Yeah, he was a nice guy. The only other thing I might mention is that there's this guy, Alan Jasper, in England. And he is making a comprehensive report over these two airplanes that crashed together that I talked to you about.
Yeah.
And he has asked me for my impression of what took place and asked me if I have any pictures, not only of the accident, which I don't, but I have other pictures of the airfield at Kim Bolton and pictures from the flying and the missions and that kind of thing. So I've emailed him that stuff. And he's putting together some kind of thing. I guess he's from a town near there where these guys crashed. And he's really going to a lot of work. Service remembrances. It was 21st of June, 2014, when those two airplanes crashed together. Yeah.
Wow.
So it's kind of interesting what he's doing. And he's really into it.
That's neat.
Yeah.